Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Megan Boxall. How are you doing, Megan?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. You survived writing the entire news section?
Yeah, it was a big week of news.
Almost literally the entire news section.
Yeah.
I think there's one article you didn't write. And James Norrington. How are you doing, James?
I'm very well, thanks, John.
Good, and you've written the cover feature this week. You've become a brain scientist for the week.
I have, yes. See how much of it my brain hasn't frozen out now already. So an interesting topic to research.
It is fascinating. So we're going to talk about the feature with James in a minute. Let's start with, we're going to talk about some results as well, because it's winding down, results season, but it's still quite busy. There's a few noteworthy results in there. But let's start with the news section. Megan, you can kick us off because you've written it all.
Well, Sky Fox is the big one, I think. I mean, it's interesting for Sky. It's interesting for Fox. It's interesting for politics. For shareholders, I mean, not a lot's changed. I think it was quite expected that Karen Bradley was going to be referring the deal to Ofcom again. I mean, it's not the first time that a Murdoch family-owned company has come hunting for Sky. And last time it was referred to Ofcom, this time it's been referred to Ofcom.
I mean, I noticed you mentioned in the piece that the shares are well below the offer price.
Yeah, about 8% below the offer price.
Which suggests to me that the market is wondering whether or speculating that this might not happen.
Yeah, that and also a lot of people were a little bit grumpy, I think, about the offer price not being what it deserved, which doesn't explain why the share price is currently below the offer price. But I do think quite a few shareholders, obviously they haven't had a chance to vote yet, but they will once all the regulatory process happens. But it looks it's just so far away. I mean, Fox said that they intend to get the deal done and dusted by the end of the year, but and Ofcom have only got 40 days to reach a decision. But even so, I mean, there's still so much to discuss.
Yeah, 40 days, I mean, that's a lot shorter than the period that they investigated
this over.
Yeah, it
took them 15 months last time.
Exactly, I think we discussed this last week. So, I mean, that would suggest that the concerns are not quite as pronounced as they were last time around.
Well, the main difference is, of course, that Fox is no longer the same company as the company that owns the Times, the Sunday Times and the Sun, which was the main issue that Ofcom had with the deal last time, the fact that Sky News and all those newspapers would be owned by the same company. Those three newspapers are owned by News Corp, which is also a Murdoch-owned company, but it's not the same Murdoch-owned company.
No, but then, well, who knows whether they look across ownership structures in that way?
No. It's an example which I think it would be very easy to say no, they would have too much control over the media because they the same family, but it also would be very easy to say, well, it's not the same company. So
sounds like work for lawyers to me. Well, let's come back to it. I mean, generally speaking, Sky as a business, what do we think of it?
Well, it seems to be doing extremely well, but the market is extremely difficult, which is another reason for this deal going through. I mean, Sky, looking forward, has got some big hurdles to overcome, Netflix, Amazon Prime being the big ones. The competition is massive.
Mm-hmm.
And Sky are paying so much for their content. They're billions of pounds for the Premier League. And it seems crazy that they're having to pay so much to outcompete these new pay TV models. So to be sort of nestled into a massive media player in the US, Fox has so much content. It does seem like a sensible decision for Sky as a company. I mean, it doesn't mean anything to shareholders because they're not getting shares for this deal. They're getting cash.
Fox could always sell that content to Sky in a commercial manner.
Yeah,
necessarily as part of the same company.
Yeah, yeah.
Netflix, yes, you're right. And Amazon are mussing on the space. But there's still a lot to be said for Sky. What does that have you on the shares?
We've got them on a hold. But they want to buy just before. I mean, there's no point in having them on anything else at the moment.
Well, it might be, because if the deal goes through 8% below
8%,
the offer price, then there's a little
8%
to be made.
You're holding them anyway.
Yeah, maybe. But we're not suggesting people take advantage of that discount to the offer price then.
Well, no, I suppose, yeah, it's definitely an argument for that.
But if you like the company's shares, then you might as well buy them, because even if the offer doesn't happen, is there some value in the company anyway?
But if the offer doesn't happen, that share price is going to crash because it was such a massive premium to the price before the offer was made, which was another reason why a lot of investors were a little bit miffed, because even though it was a massive premium to the share price before the offer was made, it was actually a discount to its 12-month high prior to that. It had had a rough year. Firstly, when Murdoch was made chairman, I think that raised a few hackles. And then all this competition, it has spent so much money on its content, which is undercutting profits a little.
Always contentious, Sky. Let's move on. Nothing really clear comes out of this so far. Right. Let's talk about drugs. To Cassia. Tell us about the deal.
Interesting deal. So Cassia was the company that had a massive disappointment 6 months ago.
With a new drug.
Or
potential new drug.
Yeah. So it's allergy immunology division, which was an incredibly exciting division. It was getting shareholders, investors really excited. It was the biggest biotech IPO in the UK in 2015, I think, 15, 14. A lot of excitement. And then last year, it failed a final stage clinical trial in that allergy department, and the share price completely crashed. But what management had done, which a lot of people were commending the management for, was they'd acquired some respiratory business, sort of prop up that high growth, high excitement allergy business, just in case it didn't come up. It was very lucky, because now that allergy business looks like it's dead in the water, they have got that respiratory division to keep them going. And that has attracted the attention of AstraZeneca, in the UK's second biggest pharmaceutical company, has come to Cassia and is going to be selling, well, it's sold the US commercial rights to two of its respiratory drugs. It's very unusual for a massive pharmaceutical company to come to what is a relatively small biotech company to sell its respiratory drugs. I mean, Astra's been doing it a lot, but it's been partnering with other big companies, not with little ones.
But Cassia's not small.
It's not big anymore after its share price.
Yeah,
issues.
But I mean, it's not a minnow. It's not a pure biotech dev type company.
But it would have done had management not made these acquisitions in the respiratory division and sourced out a pretty impressive commercial platform in the US. So Cassia is going to be selling these two drugs in the US. It's going to be paying AstraZeneca royalties. But the main part of this deal is Astra's got a big chunk of shares in Cassia, which is also interesting because it shows that, I think it shows that Astra is actually interested in Cassia's own respiratory pipeline, which it's got a few drugs in the respiratory section. Respiratory is a massive, massive part of the pharmaceuticals market. So much money in it. It's very competitive, but Astra is one of the biggest players in respiratory.
So respiratory is interesting, I guess, because there are lots of concerns. I mean, there are lots of ailments that are caused by poor air quality, for example, around the world. I mean, London is particularly bad.
Yeah,
it's been discussed for quite a lot in the past week or two.
Yeah, it has.
So respiratory growth area.
Yeah, not necessarily as fast as oncology, but less risky because, well, clinical trials are less expensive. And it's an area where pharmaceutical companies have a little bit more knowledge already, especially
AstraZeneca. Tried and tested.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it looks like a really good deal for Cassia. It's interesting because Astra has been shelving off quite a lot of its drugs because it needs the cash. It's not getting cash for this one. It's getting a big chunk of Cassia shares, which I think shows a little bit of faith in a company which could end up being quite a big respiratory player.
It's quite a new model. I've not seen many transactions like this within this space where a large pharma group has used paper as part of a deal. Could this be a model that we see more and more in this industry?
Potentially. It's interesting. I think it's unusual. I imagine what happened was Astra wanted to get rid of a few drugs. I mean, this is pure speculation, but Cassia just didn't have the cash to pay for them.
But you would expect that to be the case for many of the similar types of companies.
Yeah, but many similar types of companies don't necessarily have the commercial platform that Cassia does. The bigger ones do, but the smaller ones, which don't have the cash, don't necessarily have such strong commercial platforms.
But we've seen novel transactions in the pharma space recently. It was Novartis. There was like drug swaps, for example.
Yeah,
was it
Novartis
and GSK.
And that was an interesting one as well. They swapped assets. One GSK got one part, then they set up a new combined division. GSK's got a couple of joint ventures with big pharmaceutical companies.
Mm. Is this just moving the deck chairs around? Or could it actually change the way that the industry works?
I think the industry's changing anyway, for the better. And drugs pricing is definitely coming into that. Pharmaceutical companies are having to be more cautious. I mean, it's not the same market that it used to be, where there was a fair amount of bribing doctors to sell your drugs and heavy marketing. I mean, it's not happening to the extent that it used to be because the industry's getting better regulated. Deals like this. There is an interesting way of sort of bringing new products to market in the cheapest and most efficient way rather than just making the most amount of money for one company.
Yeah, I mean, actually, on the subject of kind of innovation in pharma, I noticed Maxite this week, which I noticed you didn't write, but I
No, I didn't
I
mind those
you
books.
Know the company.
I do. Yeah.
But, I mean, this is interesting. A small company with something that's novel that can help larger companies accelerate time to market for their products, which is obviously a big thing in pharma. So, I mean,
MaxFax is a really interesting company. It's really unusual because it has this platform, which it's a very exciting biotech platform, which is then it's sort of putting its products out for hire for big pharmaceutical companies, which they can use so that it's all to do with gene editing. So it's gene lines which they are selling to big pharmaceutical companies, which the pharmaceutical companies can use to develop their drugs quicker. And it's happening. MaxCyte isn't the first to be doing this. Horizon Discovery is another UK listed company which is doing a very similar thing, and Oxford Biomedica, whose results were also this week,
which we're not quite so positive on, however.
We're not so positive on Oxford Biomedica, but they do have similar, it's not the same, technically the same kind of platform, but it's a similar business model in that their platform's being used by Novartis, and Novartis is using that in developing its new oncology drugs.
It's almost as though it's the picks and shovels argument of the pharmaceuticals industry, which we haven't really seen before in a listed sense. But
But I suppose it all comes down to the pure science and the fact that there is so much innovation at the moment, and it's these small, really fast-moving companies which are making the greatest leaps, but they just don't have the money to see it through. And big pharmaceutical companies are taking advantage of that, and that's great.
Paper deals with big pharma. And, you know, that gets around the cash problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, maybe we'll see more of this. So let's move on to another story you've written this week, Megan, which is about a new IPO, Medica. Completely passed me by, of course, but that's why we've got you. And this is not a drug company, is it? It's healthcare, but it's doing something slightly different, which is interesting in itself.
It is. And actually, we were having a discussion the other day about where this company actually fits. I mean, it's listed as a healthcare company, but it could almost fall into a sports services company. Because it is providing a service which is analysing radiology scans, so x-rays, CT scans, remotely. So it has this sort of big group of radiologists, and the scans are sent from the hospitals to the radiologists who analyse them quickly, efficiently, using this software platform that they have. And then they're sent back to the hospital. And what Medica says they do is take out a lot of the costs from that hospital, which is really interesting at a time when so many UK hospitals, the NHS, is really struggling for time and money.
Indeed. Now, there is an obvious angle to draw from this. That this is an example of a company that is an example of the private sector encroaching into the NHS, which so many people are somewhat fearful of. But this sounds like it's a kind of good thing.
Something needs to change in the NHS. And if looking to outsourcing is the way to do that, I mean, something's got to... The NHS, which was founded however many years ago, the population is so different now. The UK population is so different now, and it's really struggling to cope with all the ageing population, the amount of chronic diseases we have. And taking costs out of the NHS doesn't mean that it's not still a free healthcare service. I mean, I think everyone is of the same opinion that we need to keep that service alive. But yeah, we have seen more people turn to private providers. I mean, Spire is one of the UK listed private hospital providers, and they've seen so many more people opting to pay themselves because they don't want to wait in the NHS queues. It's another place where private providers are helping out but also benefiting from. Emis is another company which is trying to take costs out of the NHS, and they've had their results recently as well, but they have struggled a little bit because the NHS has stopped looking to outsource as much because they just don't have the money to pay for the technology platforms that Emis is providing. But once that hurdle's overcome, these providers, Emis and Medica, could be in an incredible position to benefit because they are providing a service which should help everyone out.
I mean, I guess there is the problem that people who were previously employed by the NHS find themselves moving into the private sector.
Yeah,
And there's always going to be some tension there.
Yeah, definitely.
But actually, these kind of companies like Medica are an example of perhaps how the NHS can be helped by the private sector.
Yeah, and in doing so, and that's why I sort of I've been quite positive about Medica.
We like it, do we?
I've initiated coverage with a speculative buy because I do think there's an awful lot of room to grow in this helping the NHS out. And it's the leader in the marketplace for radiology. It's a massive thing. We're not going to stop scanning people.
So it's been around a while, this company, has it?
It has, yeah.
So this is not some, you know, set up to take advantage of the current pressures.
I don't know why, actually, they've listed right now. It's interesting. That
probably
would be
because
an interesting
they probably they want the capital to expand the business.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, right, we will talk about it very briefly, because we have talked about it on this podcast before. I feel vindicated.
I'm sure you do.
Flow Group, it's the innovative boiler company. Your boiler generates electricity, sells it back to the grid. Your boiler costs you nothing. I was always very sceptical of this idea, and it does seem to be the case that things have not gone as smoothly for them. As the kind of whole narrative of efficiency in,
you're so
in energy.
Chuffed.
I'm not chuffed. I don't want them to fail, but you know, as an investor, you've got to be sceptical sometimes.
Yeah.
The story being told is one that that lacks plausibility in some respects.
Yeah, so I think some scepticism here was well placed. I mean, they have had a really, really bad year, which has culminated in them trying to sell the good bit of the business, which is doing well.
So I never paid any attention to this bit of the business.
No, but it was doing well. So the bit of business we're talking about is the energy part, where they sell and provide energy.
It's just like an alternative energy supplier.
It's a challenger energy company. And it has been attracting a lot of new customers. I mean, the market's been quite exciting for challenger energy suppliers. So it has been doing well, but the share price has been so hammered by the boiler part of the business. This boiler that pays for itself cannot pay for itself anymore.
Yeah, that's a kind of small problem when you're trying to market a boiler as a boiler.
The marketing strategy has completely gone out of the window. They're going to try and rescue that boiler part by selling the energy part. So the share price had a great week this week because Arden Partners, which is their house broker, put out a note putting a £81 million valuation on the energy part of the business. Now, Flow Group's a 20 million.
Has somebody
company.
Agreed to buy this then, or is it?
They have
they just put
got
it up for
someone
sale?
Who no. So they've got someone. They've got a potential buyer. Apparently, they had a lot of offers. So what happened apparently is they were trying to rescue the boiler part, and they were thinking of selling the boiler part. But while they were trying to sell the boiler part, apparently they were getting a lot of offers for the energy part. Not surprising; it's a good part of the business. So they've decided to try and sell that. And £81 million. That's four times the value of the whole company. It would sort out their immediate cash problems, but it doesn't necessarily sort out the boiler part, which they are now trying to roll out in Europe, which apparently has much more generous regulations for this kind of thing.
Oh yeah, and that's largely been what's scuppered their plans.
Yes, it has been unfortunate.
The UK's feed-in tariffs regime has moved against them.
Yes, it has moved against them. But yeah, like you say, I mean, it was something that they couldn't have foreseen, but it has hit them hard.
Political risk on small technology, that sounds like two things that I would avoid like the plague. And my skepticism dial is still up there.
Skepticism dial, but in defense of the company, it could, for the non-skeptics view,
the optimist. Oh, you're leading us nicely into the next segment of this podcast.
Absolutely. is to say that having sorted out the cash problems, there could be a great market. We need more energy efficient boilers.
Yeah. Okay, we do. We have them. We have great boilers. They come from Germany.
Well, we're now going to be taking our boilers
to
Germany.
Anyway, let's move on. And yes, as I suggested there, optimism is something that is very much at the heart of what you talk about in your cover feature, James. So this feature is about the brain.
Yes.
And things that are actually happening. So we talk a lot about investor psychology, which is kind of the kind of outward effect of what's actually going on inside your brain.
Well, behavioural finance is nothing new, and we've been covering that for many years in the magazine. But actually, behavioural finance is rooted in the workings of the brain. What goes on when we make an investment decision, we are welding our cognitive biases to the narratives that we're hearing in the markets in the outside world, and we're making a decision on that basis. What neuroscientists are doing is they by using experiments where they're stimulating responses in individuals and then mapping which bits of their brain light up, they're able to tell us, they're able to show us very interestingly that actually the emotional part of our brain, as well as the thinking part of our brain, is still involved in investment decision making.
Okay, so we like to think that we are, when we are investing, we are making very rational decisions based on a lot of research and intelligence that we have and knowledge of how investment works. But actually, what we have to be careful of is that we're not being led by the emotional part of our brain.
Well, the emotional part of our brain, it lights up a lot when we are. So the pleasure centre of the brain lights up very much in anticipation of reward. So it would in reward for food, for drugs, for sex. The brain lights up, and it's the same with investment returns. The anticipation of investment returns causes the pleasure centre of our brain to light up. The thinking part of our brain, which is something which has evolved comparatively recently, it's what separates us from the apes. That does light up as well, but in anticipation of rewards, we're seeing that the pleasure centre is still very important.
So this is, I mean, we talk about risk and reward a lot when we're writing about investment, but actually this is a chemical thing, the way we anticipate reward and manage risk.
Well, it's a chemical thing, and it's different in different people. Something known as the optimism bias, which Dr. Tally Sherrott of UCL has done a lot of research into, I spoke to for the feature, and human beings have a natural bent towards optimism, towards looking for a good outcome for themselves. It's interesting. That may not tally with, some people may have pessimism about financial markets. It's been found that we are more pessimistic about outside things, about our government, about the economy, but we are optimists about ourselves. Most people would put themselves in a higher sort of decile of the global population for intelligence, for example, than they actually are, and we make investment decisions expecting a better outcome, and when they go wrong, then because we're optimists, we blame some other extraneous factor, we don't put the blame on ourselves.
Yes. Something in the brain is making that happen, though.
Something in the brain is making that happen, yes, exactly. I mean, there are parts of the brain that control our response to positive information and parts of our brain that control our response to negative information. Research has shown that the positive parts of the brain actually react far more strongly to positive information than negative parts of the brain do to negative information. So we have a natural bias that is chemical in our brains, which makes us look on the bright side. And that's evolved for all sorts of reasons. It's involved, to make you talk to that attractive person on the other side of the room, rather than staring at your feet in the corner, so that you'll breed and procreate. It's there so that you'll try things, so that we as human beings will try and invent things.
We'll take risks.
Take risks, exactly. And which obviously is very pertinent to investing.
So part of your brain is encouraging you to take risks.
Part of your brain encourages you to take risks, and that is whole systems in your brain encourage you to take risks, the emotional side of your brain and the thinking side of your brain.
And those risks are what often translate in aggregate into the returns that we have got from the stock market over many years.
Well, the aggregate, we're social apes, we're a species. And the way that people behave over many years has been a triumph of optimism, even though there has been a very famous study on stock market returns, Dimpson, Marsh and Staunton, which we've quoted many times before. The equity risk premium over the long 20th century, 1900 to 2016, it's been not much shy of 4%, I think, in the US. So it's the optimism has won out, but that's not mean that in that period there were two world wars and a Great Depression. But basically this evolutionary device that human beings have to keep trying, keep striving, has meant that overall people have made some good returns.
I mean, yeah, I've often thought about this because I think I am naturally cautious, naturally pessimistic, and I do sometimes think I've missed out on things because actually people especially in investing terms, because people who see perhaps not a more optimistic future are going to take those risks and win out, whereas I'll be sitting on a very cautious investment and not going anywhere quite so fast.
Your optimism may sort of manifest itself in other ways. We all make decisions. We have bounded rationality. We rely on heuristics with decision making, perhaps the things have influenced you in your life. Unless you are clinically depressed, then the rest of your brain probably is functioning normally. You're probably directing it differently, and you're an optimist in the sense that you're probably saying those other people are stupid. I'm smarter than everybody else. This is why I'm not investing it. So it works in funny ways. Mm. But a lot of research needs to be done into this. This is sort of we get into the realms of me theorising.
I think it's quite a good start. What's the big lesson right now? You know, from what we know so far for investors. I mean, what should investors do to manage these kind of very fundamental things going on inside their body, in their brain?
Well, I think the first thing is you're not as smart as you think you are. So, and the best thing is to plan ahead for an emotional reaction. I mean, we all know it's a bad idea to buy or sell a stock or make a decision when you're stressed, when you're wound up. That's been shown in the brain. I mean, if people take beta blockers because beta waves are more prevalent in the brain when you're stressed. But actually, there is a zone where you get the right blend of the lower frequency alpha waves, which are useful for relaxation. I mean, you have too many of those, then you're basically not really acting efficiently. But the right blend of alpha and beta waves in your brain, you work with the best level of cognitive function. So investors need to make decisions when they're in the zone. So the best way to make a decision is there are things like nootropics out there for traders, which probably I wouldn't advise for ICU.
These are drugs. Yeah.
These are drugs.
Suggesting doping for investing.
Well, no, not quite, gaming.
Well, it's not illegal.
Juicing.
It's not illegal.
No, it hasn't got a ban.
Juicing for investing. No, I'm not here to promote nootropics. I think for investors, you avoid mistakes by planning early and ahead of time,
and by
doing things when you've had a good night's sleep, when you're properly hydrated and you're well fed.
I was going to jokingly say, yes, you know, a company you own, a share you own has had a profit warning. You know, your immediate reaction is sell, but possibly sometimes the best thing to do is sleep on it.
Possibly, but I think the most important thing is that, you know, that you're queued up or you have some rules in place. That you know, if you do, you know, you use the 200-day moving average rule or something for selling, you know, just have something in place. Just know that your brain is going to trick you to do things, particularly if you're stressed. So for a buy and hold investor, it's as with a lot of things, it's just about planning.
Or go on holiday and not even bother looking at your portfolio.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, it is a complicated subject, and I think it's probably worth reading the feature to really understand some of the processes that are going on here. It is complicated. It is very complicated, and as you say, it's a science in its infancy, and has not really been applied to investing directly.
No, there's some of the early studies have looked at this. I mean, it's such a huge area. I mean, people are looking at it first for dealing with schizophrenia. The neuroscience as well.
That sounds like the stock markets.
Well, indeed. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of seems to have
risk on, risk off. Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems to swing one way to the other from day to day. Yeah. I mean, it is markets do sometimes appear to not be able to make their mind up in exactly that way. Right, we are running out of time. We've spoken about the entire news section.
Yeah.
Which is good because you were here and we could do that. We've spoken about the cover feature. There is lots more in the magazine this week, including lots and lots of results. We have Algie Hall updating his momentum screen, which was a joy to put on page last night very late because he wrote it twice as long. You can read the twice as long version on the website. Lots more in the personal finance and fund section. Has picked a good fund manager. I suspect there's some cognitive biases going on in that process too. An interesting piece about the LISA, the Lifetime ISA, which... it's an interesting alternative or addition to your pension earnings capability. Lots in the comments section, as per usual, including the latest no free lunch looking at Reckitt Benckiser. I must admit I found this article truly shocking in terms of what Reckitt Benckiser has found itself involved in recently. And wonderful. So thank you, Megan. Thank you, James. Pick up the magazine. Free your mind, understand your brain, and make better investment decisions. Available in all good news agents for £4.90. Or get online and subscribe. Or get onto iTunes and rate this podcast if you like it. So thank you very much, and we'll be back again next week. Goodbye.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners, so there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.